R22 tout le monde. Antenne cadiste.
So thank you, Iliana and Antonia, for inviting us for Future Climates. Thank you also for Cadiz team for hosting us. Really very nice to be here. We hope that we can contribute to this amazing discussion tonight on financialization and how financialization as a tool can maybe contribute or be part of sustainable practices in the art in the future. It is a question that we address in our art practice. So we'll be happy to talk a bit about what we do, show some short clips of films that we made. We'll go into the development of Art House Index, talk about that later, and we'll elaborate a bit on the research we're currently working on, a modest proposal. But first, something about Jubilee. I already took the occasion to briefly talk about it during the question moment. It's a platform for artistic research and production that we co-founded with four other artists in 2012. Jubilee means celebration, but the name actually stems from a Sumerian tradition of debt cancellation. So the image you see here is the inscription of a Jubilee debt cancellation of in the period of 2400 before Christ. A Jubilee is a periodical decree instituted by Sumerian and later Babylonian rulers to cancel the debt of their citizens and free all people that were in slavery every 7 years. So every 7 years there was a Jubilee. Every 49 years there was a restitution of land that was lost through debt accumulation. So you could say it's a mechanism to relieve social tension in societies at the time. Jubilee was actually about destroying the whole system of accounting, because what happened was these inscriptions, they were made on clay tablets, and the clay tablets, they were thrown in water. The tablets dissolved, and with the clay tablets dissolving, all the debt dissolved. That's such a powerful image, we thought, in 2012, with austerity measures and debt accumulation, euro crisis, subprime mortgage crisis, you know, all the crises that we've been accumulating. And what happened with those crises was actually the inverse Jubilee. We socialize private debt. And maybe we should go for a real Jubilee. That's what we thought. Well, it's a good name. Let's stick to that name. So what we do basically is, try to get together to sort out our problems together. We're mostly research-based practices and audiovisual production, which is lots of money, lots of contracts, complex procedures to produce the work. It functions as a kind of cooperative structure that tries to equally distribute collective resources, both socially, economically, and culturally. So we share information, network, and resources. apart from that, we also do guest projects and research projects, one of which I just mentioned, Caveat, the research into the legal paradigm in which we're working and trying to figure out if this legal paradigm contracts could be helpful in developing more sustainable environment and sustainable conditions in which we need to work, actually use the contract as an emancipatory tool rather than the neoliberal tool that it is today. You could say that initiating Jubilee is one way of dealing with our precarious situation, or trying to figure out more sustainable ways of producing work. Financialization is not yet part of that. It's a complex subject, which we try to address in our art practice as a duo. Since 2006, we have joined forces as the artist duo Vermeer and Hermans. Our focus since then has been on the dynamics between art, real estate, and economy. And this from a really very personal perspective. Because in our collaborative practice, we have one artwork, and the artwork is our house, which we define as an artwork. the home is not open for the public, but we develop mediated extensions on this house, on this private space. And these mediated extensions generate a kind of hypervisibility of the space by translating it into video films, performances, publications, but also now a lecture like tonight. Everybody thinks now, what kind of house would that be? And kind of see the roof garden, basically, with a swimming pool. So it's it's not bad, really. So, in our recent work, since a couple of years, we try to focus on financialization as this topic that we will address tonight in different stages and show some excerpts of work that kind of would illustrate that.
So we'll talk first a little bit about our new research, and we come back to the house later when we show the excerpts of the existing pieces. So when we were thinking about the precarious conditions that artists and small institutions... Does it work? Yeah. We started to look around and saw that in society there are many treasures to be found, many assets, for example, public collections, for example, or beautiful museum buildings. But the problem with these assets is that you cannot really get to their value because they are public assets, and the idea is not that they can be sold. So it means that they, in the jargon of the investment bankers, it's just frozen assets. But we thought in our new research, well, why can't we use these frozen assets and maybe start to think about financialization? So our new project is called A Modest Proposal in a Black Box, and it considers this financialization of collections and museum buildings. And financialization in this case means that you use financial instruments that make these frozen assets liquid, so you can get a stream of income, money that can flow. So our ambition with this research, we just started, is that we create a financial model. And we will not do that on our own. We will work together with some experts. And we will investigate what is possible and if it's possible for example, museum administrators to create a return on investment on all the treasures that are sitting there. But not just that, the idea is also how can it be repurposed? How can financialization models be repurposed for a more sustainable way of working so that it does not benefit what is usually the case, the investor or big institutions, but maybe also artists, art workers, and so on. But after formulating the first ideas, we thought, it's a bit strange because can you really do that? So questions about taxation and government keep popping up because, it's a strange idea that the money that you generate from certain public assets go straight to the same industry, so to speak. So shouldn't it rather be the case that there is a parliamentary debate redistribute the profits? So it's very clear that the new project generates a lot of difficult and challenging questions, and also financialization is also something that poses many, many questions. So I propose that we go into our case, the financialization of art and real estate. And then we will, from time to time, switch to some fragments of our work in moments when we think it fits also the talk about new research. And let's start about art collections first. So I give a bit of context. We found an interesting text by Rosalind Krauss already in the 1990s. And there she's speaking... The text is titled The Cultural Logic of the Late Capitalist Museum. We thought, okay, that's interesting. So in this text, she explains the cultural shift of museums. She explains that, and I quote her, "Now, non-invested surplus capital is exactly one way of describing the holdings, both in land and in art, of museums." And then she elaborates further in the text on the museum directors describing their museums as an industry, and that they need a larger inventory, so always bigger and bigger collections, that they need more physical outlets, meaning more franchises all over the world, and they need to leverage the collection. And this leveraging the collection means that they do not intend to sell it, but rather move the collection into the credit sector. So it's part of the circulation of capital. And the collection will travel, she says, as a form of indebtedness. So classically, she says, mortgaging the collection would be the more direct form of leveraging. So taking out a loan on the basis of the value of the art. So this is an account that you might think it's very much in contrast to what a museum should do. And there exist codes of ethics of museums, but these codes are not binding, legally binding, except in France, they told me, so that's weird. And these codes, they tell us that you should not look at collections as a financial asset, and you should not mortgage them, because this would also damage the public confidence quite a lot in museums. But when we read Rosalind Krauss' text and we look at what's happening today, then you can imagine that it's happening quite a lot behind the screens. And but this hiding of the logistical functions of museum behind screens is also an interesting business tactic, of course, because it sustains value, because they can keep the aura of the museum and the aura of the art. So since the 90s, I don't think much has changed. We have seen Guggenheim franchises popping up everywhere. The Louvre, Abu Dhabi, and Pompidou is coming to Brussels. It's opening a franchise in the garage, Citroën garage, in the Canal district. And the rumor has it that Brussels has to pay 1.5 million euros every year only to use the brand name of Pompidou.
This is a region that has no cultural policy officially. So it's tourism money. Great.
So then we started thinking, okay, in contrast to the museums being this industry, the stake of the public in it is largely forgotten. So then we found another interesting paper by Michael O'Hare. He's a professor of public policy at Berkeley. And his paper is titled "Capitalizing Art Museum Collections: Awkward for Museums, but Good for Art and for Society." And he describes that art museums have a strange way of accounting for him, because they fail to capitalize the collections and report these collections as assets. So he says that's quite bad for society and for art, because he wants to consider every citizen of the city where a museum is located as having a share in the investment and also a right to expect it to be used very productively. So with our proposal, we would like to take up this challenge and think more about it and think about, like, okay, are these assets, do they really belong to society as a whole? And can museum administrators generate, apart from cultural and social profits, maybe also an economic profit? And perhaps they can use some financial tools that are available in high finance. And this is exactly what is happening in the private art and finance industry. We love to go to some nice conferences of Deloitte and listen to all what they have to propose there. So they are really working hard to make the art collections, private art collections, liquid. So they are in free ports, or they are on collectors' walls, and they like to free up the flow of money that are in their frozen assets. So they develop derivatives. And derivatives are contracts between parties where the value is based on an agreed asset, an underlying asset. So this means that now it's possible to buy and sell art without actually having to take care of the physical artwork. So fractions of artworks are sold now in the form of shares. And we were also looking for some propositions that could inspire us to find more sustainable possibilities. And maybe people from London don't agree, and we didn't look. It's also only for a selection of artists, this possibility, but we thought the proposition was interesting. So there is a V22 in London, and for example, they collect artworks, and the artists then get a stake in the collection in the form of shares. So the collection is then listed on a very small stock exchange, the next market in London, and investors can then buy a share in the collection. But it means that the artist, after the work is sold, can keep a stake in this work, and also that he can keep a stake in the work of his peers. So we thought that was kind of an interesting way of doing things.
Yeah, it's a form of reusing financial strategies, but not only for the benefit of external investors, but when the artists themselves, they pay actually part of the rent of their studios with their paintings. These paintings go in a fund. Fund is listed on the stock exchange, and you get shares as an artist. So you become part of this whole system, and you're not excluded from that system. You don't give away your assets. So what Kathleen was basically speaking about is how to wake up sleeping capital and activate it through financialization for the purpose not only of, or the benefit not only of investors, but also of us stakeholders in the game. Next, we will propose to look at how this can be done with real estate, because museums often present their collections in the most beautiful buildings. And when an institution invites us to present a modest proposal, we have the choice either to work on the financialization of their collection, if they have one, or the financialization of their real estate, if they own some, or the financialization of their symbolic capital, which most of them have, big or moderate or whatever. Or they can have all three, actually. Let's focus on the real estate. We don't really think that financialization of museum real estate today exists within real estate markets. But what is clear is that museum buildings, they take up a very specific niche in the real estate market. Many cities today, and we just mentioned Brussels, which used to be the monopoly of the concrete barons of Brussels, but seems that things are changing, and they actually will follow this idea that many cities invite star architects, to design the most iconic buildings and refurbishments of old buildings. And worldwide, it is clear that this combination of unique architecture and blue chip art, blue chip poker game, the best art, the top niche of art, those two combined, they really trigger a pilgrimage of art and architectural lovers, but actually of tourists in general, which I said is funded through tourism and regeneration policies. If you look at it more carefully, the primary purpose of those buildings has nothing to do with you and me. It is actually a financial remediation, as they say, or what David Harvey, one of the more interesting urban geographers, famously termed spatial fix. And spatial fix is actually money that shifts from investment in trade and production economy to real estate investment, where it is fixed in the building, so it keeps its value, or keeps a certain value, becomes material value, hoping that the asset value of the building will grow, right? The building itself then is supposed to generate a Bilbao effect, you know, like the Guggenheim Bilbao. The effect is a regeneration or reinvigorating power for a part of the city that was a bit low in its economic activity or had a lot of problems, was a bit decrepit, stuff like that, regeneration issues. And as it happens in 2009 or 2008, during the subprime mortgage crisis, we were working on this, The Good Life, which is actually a project that proposes to the Arnold Fini Institute, used to be in that vacated area. That's what they did in the 1970s, gutted the 19th century warehouse and put in a white cube. The white cube and all the staff working there were so expensive that they couldn't offer us a production budget, which we kind of felt coming, you know. And we applied for film funding in Flanders and got that money. And then we went to an office for architecture and asked them to redesign or design a very iconic building. And then we went to the Arnold Fini again and said, listen, guys, if you can't really offer us a budget, maybe you should sell the building as 12 luxury apartments with added value, since you've been here for 50 years, and you own the building. So that was a provocative gesture, and they took a lawyer then, and we needed to take a lawyer. But in the end, we could do it. It was kind of a institutional critique is always very tricky. They like it when they're not part of it, but when they're part of it, then it becomes really. Anyway, we will show a short clip maybe of that film. It's a guided tour through the building, but it's a composition of all different white cubes. And the director of the institution is actually giving a short talk. Yeah, that one.
I think this is an incredibly original project. Obviously, at this time of economic upheaval, it's a calculated risk. But that's something that we've never shied away from. And it will bring an incredible new dimension to the city. We've always pioneered regeneration. We've made an impact over many years. And indeed, the relationship between arts and business is vital. So I think this is something that we should certainly put our energy behind. And if we can, this project will bring vibrant life among
the
rooms.
Now the building will house 12 lofts, and you'd like to know that the Good Life collection will include amenities that will strike you as superlative. I mean, we have a First Prince library, we have an indoor-outdoor sun deck with infinity pool, we have a yoga studio, a fitness centre, a steam room, and a 24-hour spa. And I forgot to mention the lobby. I mean, it's pristine white walls and double height ceilings give you the impression of a cutting edge gallery. The garden. It's a privately owned public space advertised as a European style piazza. Staff have the power to escort anyone who breaks the rules. You know, it's a very special environment and it deserves that little bit of respect.
So here's our extras as frozen assets. We actually fed the director of the Institute his own lines. He was giving an interview in the In-Flight magazine to Bristol, and he was always approached with project developers to testify how brilliant the Arnold Fini was for the whole region and how much value it contributed. So we found his interview, and then we kind of re-scripted it and gave it to him to perform in the film. There's no jokes in the film. Actually, the whole film consists of quotes. So it's all quotes from the architect's office next door that accumulated 5 years of project development in Bristol. So once the building is constructed, because you have money, doesn't go to production, it goes into real estate. That's one side of financialization. There's another side, because once you have the building, there's a whole new horizon of possibilities opening up. It's magic. financialization can actually liquefy, meaning make very liquid, turning into money, basically, stone, bricks, and glass quite easily. And a very telling example, and this is the interior garden that she mentions, really beautiful. A quite telling example that probably everybody knows is the Empire State Building. And the Empire State Building is not only a building, it is also a financial product. And it is traded on the Empire State Realty Trust, which is a real estate investment trust, a REIT, R-E-I-T. And a REIT is a financial tool that actually provides for investors an extremely liquid stake in a real estate conglomerate. So you can you have a share of the Empire State Building, makes money, you think, oh, this is a good time to sell, I need some cash, you sell it with a mouse click, basically, from bricks to clicks. That's financialization for you. Really, it's incredible. So we thought, well, if this is happening to the Empire State Building, it might happen to a conglomerate of unique museum buildings. Why not bring them together in a kind of grouping and figure out ways to make this real estate into money, which we can actually think about how to redistribute this money in a more, let's say, shared way or different way than usually is the case. We found, actually, we had to look hard, but we found a more sustainable way of financializing real estate, and it's called PropTech Crowd. PropTech Crowd. I didn't know it. Kathleen found it, so I'll just read a bit. PropTech Crowd combines financial technologies, property, and crowdfunding. It allows small investors to invest in property shares through setting up a legal entity, a so-called special purpose vehicle. This is something that we're researching, special purpose vehicle, for each building that is acquired through crowdfunding. And in that way, they avoid mortgages and banks. So they actually crowdfund the building of houses. And part of their offering through crowdfunding is social housing projects for investors. So that seems to be at least an effort to do something more generous with this mechanism.
So does it mean that we are very positive then about the possibilities of financialization and its effects? Well, it's very ambiguous, of course, and it's a dangerous tool. Because, yeah, for example, the company that Ronnie was just describing, it's a very small remedy. By using financialization against the effects that financialization caused in the first place. And the effects of financialization is a bigger exposure to financial markets, rising property prices, and also that people have to leave the city because it becomes too expensive. So we are working with financial geographers, and they are people that study the effects of financialization on the city and also on the fabric of daily life. And we thought that was also very interesting. So they call all this the politics of mass financialization. And what do they mean with that? It's, they mean like governments these days in neoliberal times, they choose to decline the welfare provisions and instead promote asset-based welfare. And this means that they try to encourage as many people as possible to acquire more assets by taking on more and more debt. And debt to start an education, to buy a house, to consume products. So this means that that they think that people can take better care of themselves. They don't have to wait for the government to help them. And it also means that if more and more people take on more debt, to buy houses and the values rise, that more and more people have a stake in these ever-rising values. And the politicians and the regulators will stay away from it to regulate it or to clean up this scheme. So this opens up questions about governing as well. And regarding the influence on daily life, owning a home is not just owning a place that is a very intimate place, but it's at the same time a machine of speculation and increased risk. For example, these days the mortgages are packaged and repackaged and repackaged and then sold to investors worldwide. So people owning a house and a mortgage, they are really exposed to financial risk in the market.
So again, when we think of this daily life operations and considering that we have only one artwork to consider, which is our private house, we thought, well, maybe we should do something about that. And we created a small publicity clip to promote our investment scheme, basically. It's called A Frontier Investment Opportunity. Not really a video. It's a collage of photos, basically, that tries to promote the financialization of our house that we defined as an artwork. What you see is basically all views through the window gathered worldwide, city views, landscapes, but all the places that we used for that are places in which we presented or produced our work. So basically it is a visual biography, or it is a video version of our symbolic capital. And as such, we thought it was an eloquent image to promote something that we have named Art House Index. And it's a nice house, but it's not the end. Maybe we should have a look at this index, because Art House Index tries to investigate how we could financialize this house as an artwork, but also the symbolic value that we as artists through the years have accrued, have brought together, how to make liquid this value. And liquid also means the most liquid financial thing is money. One-on-one, that's liquid, ultimate liquid. So how to make this house as artwork liquid without having to sell it, because otherwise we would no longer have a house, of course. The result is Art House Index. It's an experimental financial index. We're making a loss, I can see now, unfortunately. It measures the economic and kind of a mixture of economic and art values. An index basically is a tool for measurement, and it kind of measures the performance of a part of the economy. You all know about the Dow Jones or the S&P 500. In France, it's the CAC 40. We have the Bel 20. In our case, it's a dynamic mixture of art and real estate. And you see a number, and that is not a price. That's a marker. It's just a figure. Could be anything. You start from something, and it becomes something else. That's the dynamic. So how did we construct this? There's a number of parameters that we use for that. Parameters that basically were brought together with information, with numbers available on the internet, coming from the global real estate market, the global art market, and currency markets. And each of these markets brought in a number. We didn't think that every number was equally important, so we weighed the importance of the number, put it in a formula. But in the process, we realized something was missing, and actually what was missing was us, our symbolic value. So we also brought in some attention economy, people looking at our films on the website, people visiting, and that became part of that formula. And that's what's been online since May 2015. And it follows the markets up and down, up and down. And it's constantly recalculating itself. To round up, or beginning of a roundup, we'd like to present a short fragment, four chapters, of a film we made on the development of this index. It's a film called Masquerade. It's a fake reportage, or a fictitious reportage, in which a TV reporter is telling the story of the public launching of this index. Masquerade is based on the last novel of Herman Melville. It's called The Confidence Man, His Masquerade. Melville is the writer of Moby Dick. His last novel, The Confidence Man, is from 1857. It's a novel which is a critique on a culture of professional trust in which all human relations are considered financial transactions, basically. It's a filmic story in 45 chapters that narrates a series of exchanges between a so-called confidence man, and this means the opposite of what you think it means. It's a con man, it's a cheater, trickster, and his victims. For this, Melville uses language as a medium. So he uses language to try to figure out how can you judge a person which is in front of you and you don't know anything about him. So what kind of language is playing there? So this inspired us actually to use film as a medium to speak about trust and confidence, which is basically what finance is all about. You don't know what we did. It's a propriety index. You can say anything. But confidence actually generates value in this context. So what we did for the film is it was largely shot in a green key, which is this action movie vehicle. You film people in front of a green cloth, and in post-production you can put in any image that you like. So we did things like that. And this basically is a basic consideration of truthfulness of the image. Is it a real image or is it completely fake, constructed? So when we present Masquerade, for us the live version of the film is the ultimate version, and the live version is actually generated by the performance of this index. So when this index goes up, you see a finished film. When the index goes down, you see the rehearsal version or the non-post-produced version, in which the lady who's doing the reporting all of a sudden finds herself alone in front of a green cloth and she misses her lines, basically. So the conditions of the production of the film actually are unveiled by, well, we use the market as an engine, as a tool to do this. And in that way, create this story on confidence and trust. For the occasion, we can't do it live here because it's unpredictable. We don't know what happens. So to know which part of the film would be most best to show tonight, we kind of faked it. So sorry for that.
So we just chose 4 chapters to illustrate a bit.
It's very short chapters, don't worry.
You're combining at this moment art, but also real estate. So that's the combination of the Art House Index. And if you combine art and real estate, well, both of these markets are really confronted with a liquidity problem.
But Frank, what is a liquidity problem?
Well, assets that can be bought and sold very easily and very fast, for instance, within a mouse click, those assets are called liquid, so they are transferable and tradable very easily.
So what you are saying is that constructing an index on the art house makes it liquid?
It's more that it converts the house into an index, into a financial medium. In your case, we're talking about this global and virtual house with the signature of the artist.
The more liquidity you bring to a market, the more confidence you bring to it, and so more money flows. The creation of confidence, I sometimes think, is the cultural artifact of the second half of the 20th century, far more striking than any given painting or sculpture.
Let's go further into the asset. The art house that masquerades as unique developments around the globe. As this is the underlying of Art House Index, I think it needs to be valued in some way, no?
A lot of it is instinct and it's difficult to explain. To be honest with you, I can just feel it.
Of course, there will still be volatility, but there's a game of it now. In Wall Street, it used to be called pump and dump. Find a cheap stock, talk it up, and sell it at massive practice. Sorry. Sorry, Thomas.
In the art world, it's not only legal, it's done regularly. And there are people out there who create the insider information.
Why did you not entrust the value in the art house, as you said, the underlying asset of art house index, to a kind of art rating agency?
An art rating agency would take us in the right direction, since it would make public the estimations and discourses on the art house.
I can see your point, but how would the artists get important peers to invest in the project? How, for instance, would they get you to be part of the art rating agency?
They just need to keep doing what they're doing. It is not unlike a process that they're already part of. Their participation in the art world already generates a surplus value. It contributes to ever-rising profits all around them. Maybe not in a financial sense, but they're definitely part of what we could call a market of ideas.
I should have mentioned that the film takes you to all these different environments that are all crucial for the creation of value, both in art and in finance. So it's like a gallery opening, an auction, a trading pit. And of course, there is some issues with transparency, so you have a court case as well, of course. The question, of course, in this context is whether Art House Index has offered us a solution to create a more sustainable practice for us. Well, as we said, it's an experiment, and it's a tool of measurement, so you can literally invest in it. It's not a financial tool. But as we claim in the film also, you could imagine that you could create a market around this index. You could develop financial derivatives like futures or options that would speculate on the future value or the future position of that index, and in that way create a market and generate value for both the investor and us, the issuer of the product. So we'd basically make a living. It doesn't really matter that much whether it goes up or down, because you can always short the market, and then you make a profit on our loss. So it's not really that important.
Yeah, so the financial experts we were working with, they were quite amused with this index and the idea of trying to financialize just our own house and just one house. So we learned from them it's maybe a better idea to be more ambitious and look into public assets, perhaps, like the collections and the museums. And we try to see if we can work out with them a financial tool that could redirect us to more sustainable uses. So how do we continue from here? So we will propose next our financial model, if we ever get there, to the board of directors of a small gallery in London, a Pump House Gallery. And we're invited there for a show next year. And the building is owned by the local council. And close to the building, as you can see, is this gargantuan development around Battersea Power Station, so an old coal station, power station. Yeah, and so apart from the building itself becoming a luxury mall and the future offices of Apple, all the apartment around it will be developed by Frank Gehry and Foster and Partners, so all luxury apartments. And so we thought, this will really cause the real estate prices to rise in the area. So what we try to do is financialize this tiny little spot there in the park and try to create a balance.
Thank you.